scientists have been able to detect hundreds of planets outside our solar system orbiting faraway stars. Mostly these planets seem to be gas giants, like Jupiter. But recently, astronomers have been getting closer to finding one like Earth. Earlier this year, they reported finding a small, rocky planet. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, they have now found one that's probably mostly water.
The name of this new planet is GJ-1214b. Every day and a half, it circles a small reddish star. Scientists detected the planet by watching that star. They saw the star dim slightly as the planet crossed in front of it, and could see how the star wobbled as the planet's gravity pulled on it. All that told them the size of the planet and how much it weighed, letting them figure out what it's likely made of.
This is certainly the first planet around another star, which we think is mostly made of water.
That's David Charbonneau at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He led the team, which is reporting on this planet in the journal Nature.
We think what we have here is a water world with a thin atmosphere surrounding it, perhaps of hydrogen and helium.
Pretend you could get in a spaceship and go to this planet, which you can't since it's 40 light years away, but if you could, first you'd see the dim red star. Then you'd see the planet, about 2.5 times the size of Earth, and shrouded in an alien atmosphere.
And then if you imagine descending down into that atmosphere, which I would advise against because of the very high pressure, and then looking back, you would slowly see this red, faint, illuminating star fade out of view and ultimately disappear from view just due to the thickness of the atmosphere.
You'd be in darkness, and then maybe splash into an ocean. Even though this planet is about 400 degrees Fahrenheit, the pressure of the atmosphere could keep water liquid. Liquid water usually excites scientists because it supports life on Earth. But Charbonneau says completely dark, super hot water under crushing pressures doesn't seem so friendly.
The surface of our planet probably wouldn't be anything like the surface of the Earth and therefore wouldn't host life as we know it.
He says additional telescope observations should reveal more about the planet's atmosphere. Mark Kushner is a planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He says it's possible this planet is made of something other than water, but the water world explanation is appealing, since our own solar system has planets like Neptune made of ice.
And it's easy to imagine a world like that located much closer to its star, so it's hot and the ice is melted into water.
Kushner says this is only the second time scientists have been able to figure out the likely composition of a planet not too much bigger than Earth around a distant star. That other planet is too dense to be made mostly of water. Instead, it's probably a super hot, rocky planet covered in lava. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Getting laid off is one way to lose health coverage. Another is becoming less poor. In a moment, how a young woman who became the first in her family to go to college ended up having to choose between books and medical treatment. First, this report by NPR's Joanne Silberner on a woman who is unemployed and coming to the end of the federal assistance that has helped her keep her health insurance.
Last year, 62-year-old Anne Hess of Atlanta was two decades into a job as a Gal Friday at a mergers and acquisitions firm. Gray-haired and twinkly, she thought her main challenges were learning to live as a widow, her husband had passed away, and figuring out how to deal with her elderly mother, who has Alzheimer's disease.
Then last year, we were told that the office was closing, and we were all out of a job.
Hess opted to take advantage of COBRA. That's a law that allows people to buy health insurance from their former employers for up to 2 years. The people who've lost their jobs pay their full health insurance premiums, but do get the benefits of the employer's discounted group rates. Despite the cost, Hess signed up. She didn't want to go without health insurance. But then she got a bit of a break. Last March, the federal government offered to pay 65% of the monthly premium for people like Hess who'd been laid off recently.
With the subsidy, I went down to $186, approximately, and now that it's has finished, I think it's going to be $510 a month.
Finished? That's because the subsidy is currently scheduled to last only 9 months. That's until December 31st for Hess, unless Congress extends the program. Otherwise, in a couple of weeks, Hess will be faced with coming up with $510 a month for health insurance. When she loses her unemployment benefits, also at the end of this month, she'll be making less at a part-time job than what it would cost her to buy health insurance.
So what will you do?
I don't know. I really honestly don't know.
She and her husband had money in the stock market. That's gone. Her savings are disappearing, and she's got to care for her mother. Ann Hess is facing a life where health insurance, if she can find any in the tough individual market, could bankrupt her. That's left her feeling vulnerable and
angry. Angry that I worked so hard all my life to wind up where I am. My life used to be going out with friends, buying nice Christmas presents for family. All that's gone now because I can't afford to do any of that. Health insurance has a lot to do with it.
The loss of the federal subsidy that Hess was depending on shows a gap in the safety net, according to Ron Pollack. He's executive director of Families USA, a consumer advocacy group.
The average COBRA premium for family coverage consumes more than 83% of the average unemployment insurance check.
Pollack's organization recently did a study that shows that without the federal subsidy, most people who've been laid off can't afford the health insurance coverage.
This, which is the best alternative for people, is unaffordable unless they get help, and that's where the subsidies come in.
And the federal subsidy has been good for businesses. James Gelfand of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says the subsidies are a cost-effective way to keep people insured. Critics of the entire healthcare system and the changes now under consideration say the need for a subsidy shows how weak our whole general approach to healthcare is. Michael Cannon is with the Libertarian Cato Institute.
The problem with the COBRA subsidies is not so much the subsidies themselves as the fact that they're a Band-Aid on a much bigger problem that the government created, and they aren't stanching the bleeding.
The current plans to overhaul the health system could help people like Ann Hess, but wouldn't kick in for a few years. There is a chance Hess can get another break, at least temporarily. The House of Representatives passed a spending bill yesterday that includes an extension of the subsidy for another 6 months and expands the program to include people laid off through next February. The Senate is taking it up later this week. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
Random House has upped the ante in the fight over who owns what in the world of digital books. The publishing company insists it controls the digital rights to its backlist. Those are the books that continue to sell years after they are first released and produce a lucrative revenue stream. Writers or their families say the e-book rights belong to them. And some are looking around for more profitable deals with new publishers. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
With the electronic book market heating up, Random House CEO Marcus Dola decided to take the offensive. In a letter to literary agents, Dola set out to describe how Random House could help writers navigate the digital publishing world. But in the letter, Dola also said there had been some misunderstandings about who owned the digital rights for older titles on their backlist. Random House began including digital book rights in its contracts in 1994, but Dola maintained that its older contracts also gave the company the right to publish books digitally. Random House spokesman Stuart Applebaum.
Our contracts give us the right to publish a work, quote, in book form, unquote, or in any and all editions, unquote. That contract language is intended to encompass all text-based versions of the work, including what are now electronic publishing formats.
The Random House letter came not long after the family of one of its longtime authors, William Styron, reached an agreement with a new publishing company to re-release a number of his novels as e-books. Similarly, the best-selling author Stephen Covey announced that he was going around his publisher, Simon & Schuster, to make a direct deal with Amazon for the electronic release of two of his books. Paul Aiken, the executive director of the Authors Guild, which represents writers, says such developments are making publishers nervous. But he says that doesn't justify what he called Random House's retroactive rights grab.
A contract is a contract. Random House bargained for what it bargained for back in 1993 and earlier. You don't get to expand the rights just because there are economic difficulties in the industry.
Aiken says the question of who owns digital rights has already been settled in the writer's favor in a court case that also involved Random House. The publisher maintains that case ended in a settlement, and so no final ruling was issued. There may be more legal proceedings ahead before the question of digital rights is resolved. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Few sectors have been hit harder by the recession than the building industry. Less than half as many new homes are being built these days than 2 years ago. Still, for people in the business of land conservation, this has opened up opportunities they never expected. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Amy Standen reports.
Here at Bruin Ranch, there are four lakes, 3 miles of pristine river frontage, and countless blue oak trees. Until recently, this 2,500-acre spread just north of Sacramento was the personal refuge of one man, rancher and businessman Lloyd Harvego.
I can come out here, take the grandkids fishing, and if I want to go ride on my quad, I can go do that for 3 or 4 hours and never see anybody.
But Harvego's also been trying to sell this property, which was zoned for 900 new homes. At one point, Bruin Ranch was on the market for $30 million. Had a deal gone through, this would have been a very different place.
Most of the housing would be up there on that hill. They would all be on large lots and would be nestled in between the trees.
But those plans belonged to a different housing market before home sales here in Placer County went into free fall. Dean Worley is an analyst with the Sullivan Group Real Estate Advisors.
Here, let me give you the percent drop. It's going to be brutal. Let's see.
Worley calculates that in 2002, there were 5,000 new home sales in Placer County. In 2009, just 1,200. That's a 76% drop.
It's really an extraordinarily slow year in terms of new home sales.
Which was bad news for Lloyd Harvego, but good news for Megan Wargo. She says she's had her eyes on Bruin Ranch for years.
Yeah, for at least a decade.
Wargo is a project manager for the Trust for Public Land, a national nonprofit group that buys land to be set aside as open space.
It's really rare to find a property this size in western Placer County that is intact. It's a special place.
The Trust for Public Land, along with the Placer Land Trust, is in the process of raising about $13 million in state and private money to buy this land. The two groups say it could be the centerpiece of a major new public park.
With this piece of land, we're actually have the ability to connect up over 6,500 acres of protected land that's permanently protected. Probably an unparalleled hiking experience in the foothills of the Sierra.
At a time of unparalleled opportunities for land conservation in general.
The phone is ringing off the hook in a number of our markets.
This is Will Rogers, president of the Trust for Public Land.
Whether it's beachfront property in Hawaii or in Florida or Civil War battlefields and farms in Georgia, I mean, it's all over the place.
Rogers says he's hearing from developers who took out loans to buy a piece of property but have now decided it isn't worth it to develop.
Oftentimes we're seeing land that's fully entitled, ready to go. They've spent years assembling the property, getting the permits and whatever they need to be able to move ahead, and now there's just no market.
But just because there's opportunity doesn't mean that land trusts are able to grab it. That's because the same recession that sent real estate prices into freefall has also hit the nonprofit sector.
That's the real irony of this situation. Now when we have the best opportunities in my career to be resources available to do that conservation work are really drying up.
Jeff Danter directs the Nature Conservancy in Florida.
It is incredibly frustrating. We're having to say no to a lot of conservation transactions that normally we would be very excited about.
Which means that land trusts, like a lot of nonprofits, will be making their appeals to donors this year with a new sense of urgency. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen.
Finding a new CEO may be a relief, but Bank of America's troubles are not over. The bank, like the whole industry, has an image problem which the bank wants to improve. From member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, Julie Rose reports.
What better way to shake the fat cat moniker than to offer something to the little guy? Bank of America says it will boost its loans to small businesses by $5 billion next year. Molly Brogan says that's welcome news. She's with the National Small Business Association.
While I do think that it is a smart, you know, perhaps PR campaign, I think they're looking over their balance sheets in the last several years, realizing that their small business loans are down significantly.
Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis said in a statement his company is determined to do its part to help the economy grow next year. Banking expert Tony Plath says Lewis is sincere, but also has another goal.
Repairing some of the public damage that perhaps the last few years have caused.
Plath teaches at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. He notes Bank of America is now running new ads in heavy rotation on outlets including NPR. They tout a year-old commitment to lending in low-income communities. Bank of America also recently repaid its $45 billion in TARP money to further distance itself from fat cat status. For NPR News, I'm Julie Rose in Charlotte.
One way or another, it looks like electric companies and manufacturing plants will have to control their greenhouse gas pollution. The Environmental Protection Agency is working on rules to require that. But most businesses say they would much prefer that Congress set the rules and create a market-based system to cut emissions. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren looks into why.
Frank Prager is a vice president of Xcel Energy, which provides electricity and natural gas to millions of residents and businesses in the West and Midwest.
We're going to have to change the way we do business a lot to be able to meet the emission reduction requirements that are almost certainly going to be imposed on us.
He says the future will look very different for his company if Congress fails to act and lets the EPA set the rules.
We're not excited about that future. In fact, it's a very difficult future.
Prager says if EPA is in charge, each time a company builds a new plant or expands an operation, government officials would have a say in what kind of fuel is used and what pollution controls are installed. Let's say his company is planning to build a new coal plant. The EPA might require the company to install very expensive equipment to capture the carbon dioxide. But if Congress sets up a cap-and-trade program, the company would have broad leeway. It could, say, build the coal plant without the costly pollution controls, but also build a big wind farm, which would not pollute at all.
So, from our perspective, a flexible market-based program would do a much better job in allowing us to bring renewable energy online.
In a cap-and-trade system, polluters would need allowances for every ton of greenhouse gases. They would buy and sell them in a new market. The quicker a company cleaned up, the less it would have to spend to buy allowances, and the more it could make selling them. Steve Cornelli is a senior vice president of NRG, a huge electric company with plants in 12 states. He also prefers a cap-and-trade approach. He says EPA regulations cannot bring about the deep cuts in greenhouse gases scientists say are needed to prevent catastrophic climate change.
The only way it works is for Congress to pass a fairly comprehensive climate and energy bill. EPA's efforts really will not succeed environmentally, and there will be a very large burden on us and other companies.
On the one hand, his company probably could build new natural gas plants, which pollute about half as much as coal plants. But it would also likely have to spend a lot of money tweaking its coal plants.
And that could very well be things like increasing the efficiency of the boiler or the turbine or co-firing a little bit of biomass with coal. We can do those things, but they won't reduce CO2 emissions very much. So we do less of the stuff that really moves the needle in terms of reducing CO2.
Like building new nuclear plants, which don't produce carbon dioxide but are very expensive. Bills before Congress would give big subsidies and incentives for nuclear plants, as well as for renewable energy and new technologies that make coal cleaner. Still, some business representatives say the pollution cuts being considered by Congress are so fast and deep that EPA regulation might be the lesser evil.
Everyone would prefer a different solution.
Lobbyist Jeffrey Homestead represents energy companies and other businesses.
But so far, the options that are on the table are not very good ones.
Homestead and others say the bills would be too painful for the economy because they push pollution cuts before cost-effective technologies are available. That's a big part of the reason that the legislation is stalled in the Senate. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.